How are you, man?
How are you?
Okay, so you're on your way, you're in Manhattan on your way to Pittsburgh?
I am on my way as we speak, yes.
Now, give me the rundown, Chris. I know, we all know why the premiere was delayed because of the lamentable, unfortunate confluence of last week's tragedy. And you guys wanted to give that little space and give the whole thing a break. So is what was postponed happening tonight? Is that what's going on? Or?
Yeah, that for me it was a respect for, it was going to go off the day after the Sandy Hook
right.
Tragedy. And so and it was an outdoor event at 2 in the afternoon. It was a big.
Well, it's funny. When I watched your film last night, Jack Reacher, I got a little ping when it happened. Are you there still, Chris?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I thought you went away. I got a little ping, but it really didn't. What happens is that you react like anybody else would to the very beginning of the film, which involves a sniper taking shots at people. But very quickly, you realize that you're in the middle of a urban thriller that is actually, just stops you in your tracks. It's actually thoughtful and careful and engrossing for that, which is, I just completely didn't expect that. That's not what the 21st century urban action thriller is doing. So perhaps you could explain how you guys came to make this kind of film, which I really didn't expect. I don't think anybody else was either. So.
When we originally set out to make the movie, there had been other attempts to adapt this book. And with every one of them, there were attempts to establish some sort of stakes and some sort of an emotional drive for the main character. There had been attempts to bring elements from other books in. In the first book, Reacher's brother is killed, and so the idea was to sort of fold Reacher's brother into the stakes of it somehow. And okay. When I was reading the book, I thought the answer's right here. It's the victims.
Uh-huh.
The victims in the book are not really fleshed out.
Right. Okay.
And I just felt that on screen I had to do that. And going all the way back to when I directed The Way of the Gun, the first shootout in the movie is all played off camera.
Mm-hmm.
And what's left are the bodies that are left behind. That's a consequence of me being pushed to make a crime film, and I really didn't want to.
Yeah.
And one of the things that always bothered me about the crime genre is what made it okay. You find reasons to make criminals sympathetic for what they do, and then that seems to make everything that they do all right. I wanted to cut against that.
Right. Yeah.
So for me, the depiction of violence is always about the consequences of violence, and so that's how that sequence came together. And mm-hmm. and the idea of how I structured how I cast those people that I used in the shots was very considered. If I had five women, it was going to be all about somebody targeting women, so that I knew I couldn't have all women.
Yeah, right.
But I also knew that I wanted to mm-hmm. lean it more toward women, because I felt, and perhaps cynically,
right.
that the killing of men was going to be less emotional and less disturbing than the killing of
right.
women.
Right.
And I wanted the archetypes of each woman to be immediately identifiable,
mm-hmm.
so that any woman watching it could see herself in one of those four victims.
Right.
Because I knew that the male perspective was going to be such that men are just going to be sitting there eating their popcorn, and I felt as though they would be less emotionally
mm-hmm.
attached to the violence than women would. And that the one thing that would get a guy would be, a young, attractive woman. And that was the purpose of introducing that sequence, designing that sequence to start on the young girl and let everybody think she'd gotten away.
Right.
And then bring it back. So I sat there and I tried to watch the sequence the way I watched those movies that handled violence in a much more visceral way when I was growing up, and kind of tried to analyze my own responses to that.
Right.
I tried to bring all of those out in that opening sequence, because first and foremost, I wanted it to be emotionally disturbing. At the same time, I didn't want it to be punishing, and that's why we're very careful in terms of the way we handle blood and when to cut into that shot. We shot that all as one continuous master.
Okay.
And then chose the moments when to cut into it.
Right. I was aware, very much so, from the get-go, that there is a very clear effort, a determination on your part to not push the audience's face in excessive, what does the word excessive mean? That's all in the mind of the beholder. But what I felt that you were holding back, not being chicken shit in terms of your depicting a rough story, rough characters, but there's definitely a feeling of you made choices to not go whole hog and to show a little restraint. And I just, what I got was an intelligent sensibility dealing with a thriller genre in a lean, sort of stripped down way. It was really, really quite surprising and delightful. So, anyway.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I feel like, you know, there's a, I don't know if you've ever seen the movie, I'm sure you've seen the movie, Pick Up, John Frankenheimer.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, 86 or something, Roy Scheider, right?
Yes, yeah. Roy Scheider and Kelly Preston. There's a scene in that movie in which they kill Kelly Preston in order to get at Roy Scheider, and they put it on videotape, and they show it in this really, really sort of punishing way. It's very effective.
Right.
It's really quite brilliantly done. But it's the sort of thing that stays with you 2 days after you've watched it. It really leaves you. It pushes past the curtain to the point where you really feel like you've witnessed the senseless murder of somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And that I, you know, that was the thing that I didn't want. And we shot the violence in a way that, you know, those scenes were in their first pass were cut. They were cut to more of an extreme.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of care spent in terms of how much time we, you know, how much time we spent on each individual thing and planing that back, sort of pushing it as far as we could, but then at the same time, as you said, not kind of rubbing your face in it.
Yeah.
What I really wanted was for this movie to be a range of emotions. I wanted you to feel the danger when it was dangerous, and I wanted you to feel the humor when it was funny. And the balance that you have to strike between the two, it pushes it too far, it becomes a violation, and then, you know, you're kind of, it becomes exploitive.
Now, the reason, one of the reasons I was surprised, because, you know, first of all, I didn't do the work that I should have done, which is read the Jack Reacher novel. Never done that. So all I had coming from was basically most people saying earlier in the game that Cruise isn't big enough to play Jack Reacher. You know, he was 6'5 in the book. So that naturally told everybody, that a key element in the Jack Reacher character is that he's Paul Bunyan, and he can, you know, he's quite, you know, he can kick anybody's ass with one hand tied behind his back. That is not what this thing is about. That's the big surprise. It's about a patient, methodical, sharp guy who pays attention to facts, who remembers serial numbers. You know, it's just completely on a different level what I thought it was going to be. So, I don't know why they made a big deal about him being 6'5". It doesn't matter. I mean, I didn't think about it for a second. So,
well, what's interesting is you perceived everything that exists behind that mass of a man, and you know that very much is the character in the book. So the problem is that on the page, even with the mystery that exists in the very novel,
mm-hmm.
you see things when it is necessary for you to see them. Reacher's size is important when Lee Child makes you aware of Reacher's size when it's convenient to Lee Child.
Yeah.
Because you're reading a book and you're not really thinking about his size all the time.
Yeah.
Problem is that in a movie, if I were to cast the 6'5", 250-pound, blonde-haired, blue-eyed archetype that is that character. Not that that actor exists or ever has.
Yeah.
But if I were, then I'd have to, in order to make a fight scene work with that guy, I'd have to cast a bunch of guys who were 6'8". And it would start to feel a little bit like the Schwarzenegger movies of the early. It would start to feel like Commando.
Yeah.
It was like the whole movie was populated by guys on steroids so that they could fight Arnold.
Right.
And really, for Don Granger and I, the producer, when we first sat down to start to talk about casting this movie, size really became an impediment. And when we let that go, the movie kind of opened up. Mm.
I didn't know anything either, which I was I'm sort of amazed by, this kind of samurai zen aesthetic going on with him, with no traveling around on buses, no cars. I think I heard in the early part, no ID. Very much the man of the shadows, and not even carrying around a couple of spare T-shirts. I mean, washing his T-shirt in the sink at night. I love that stuff. That's totally one of the most original things for a protagonist in an urban thriller. I just thought that was terrific.
So that was all taken. That's all the stuff that I love,
right,
that Don and I both love about the books.
Yeah.
And the idea that this is a character who is totally free.
Yeah.
And free in the sense of a contemporary, 21st century ideal. The idea that he has no cell phone, no email, no home address, no fixed address, no taxes, no family.
Yeah.
And that more importantly, it isn't necessary, it's a discipline. It's something that requires a certain amount of concentration and a certain amount of dedication, and it comes at a cost. And the value of that is that is Reacher's only baggage. You're man with no name, you're a drifter, you're Jimbo,
right,
has to have some sort of thing hanging over him, and Reacher doesn't. And that's the thing that I love about him, is he's not running from something, and he's not searching for anything specific.
Yeah.
And that allowed you to take a slightly lighter point of view. He doesn't have to be, he doesn't have to be so down. It allows Tom to play a character who's much lighter on his feet, and much less in a hurry than characters played before.
Yeah. What do you mean by that? You know, it's funny. I've had friends, director friends, and they said that you were quoted recently as saying that you were in director jail for 12 years, and I won't name who I'm talking about, but one guy said, you don't realize you've been in jail until about a year into it. Then you realize it's happening. It doesn't come to you right away, but once you realize you're in director jail, then you have to figure out ways to extricate yourself, he said. Is that what you did?
It's what I spent those intervening 12 years doing, was trying to figure that out. And only when I let go of that, when I took the attitude, when Don Granger came to me with with the book, and said, I'd like you to direct this, I said, well, I'm not going to help you do that. I'm not going to ask permission anymore. And if the studio says I can do it, if they'll offer me the movie, then I'll do it. But I'm not going to pursue this.
Right.
And what ended up happening is I inadvertently created a situation where someone else was invested in my success. And it's really a testament to Don that he went and that he convinced the studio to make that choice, and then that's kind of where everything turned around. It's the kind of thing. It's to put it crudely, you can't get laid when you're trying.
Yeah, yeah, right. What's the deal, by the way, with the other writer who was on it and he did some work, and then you came along and did the rewrite? And usually, what happens in those instances is a guy winds up, if the, say, the director, the auteur of it, if you will, he does the definitive rewrite, what usually happens is that the earlier writer will wind up with a standard story by credit. And yet this guy, who I'm searching around online to find it, but I don't
see Josh Olson.
Yes.
Josh Olson.
Yes. So what was the deal with that? How come he didn't end up with a story? Isn't that fairly standard for the type of thing?
It usually is, especially when the director does it, because even though I'm a writer first and foremost,
right,
in the eyes of the guild,
yeah,
I think, I'm a director in that case. It's a matter of a straight adaptation. What happens is when you adapt a screenplay from a novel, anything taken from the novel is essentially moot, essentially inadmissible, and all they look at is original material created outside of
Got
the novel.
Right.
And what Josh Olson did was he wrote a very able straight adaptation of the novel.
Right.
And what I did was a fair amount of reinterpretation of the novel in order to capture the spirit of the novel. For example, you conceal the in the book, Lee Child conceals the identity of the shooter and only reveals that it's Barr towards the end of the movie.
Right.
And one of the first things I did was jettison that idea because I didn't believe A, it was a satisfying reveal, and B, I thought, on film, if I'm hiding the identity of the shooter, the audience is going to know something is up. And they're always going to be questioning whatever reality they saw in the beginning of the movie. I have to confront this. And quite honestly, after working on a movie like The Tourist, where you spend the whole movie trying to hide something from the audience, it's exhausting. It's very inhibiting.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to deal with that sort of mystery. I wanted the mystery to be more of an episode of Columbo.
Yeah.
And the idea that a crime occurred and it's to the audience's point of view completely unsolvable, and they're ahead of the main character, and the fun is watching how he unravels it. So changes like that created a great deal more original material outside of the original narrative, and that's where in the case of an adaptation, that's where the credit determination goes.
So what you've just explained to me about the aesthetic and about approaching a film from a very careful, very intelligent, sort of stripped down narrative, I completely accept. Tarantino was just saying the other day on CNN that the use of third act violent catharsis, resolutions of dramatic conflict with violence in the third act goes back to the days of Shakespeare. I would say that his stuff is so flip, and it's sardonic, and it's kind of cinematic style violence. It's violence as irony, it's violence as reference back to spaghetti westerns. All these things going on in his films. There's just a straight level of sincerity in your thing. I realize it's a kind of style which you've done. You've chosen a certain way of doing it. It's like you're doing that great film that Duvall was in that I've loved for years, and I know that he respects The Outfit. Have you ever seen that one?
Oh yeah, no, I read your article and I loved when you referenced that the scenery rips off the card game, and I love the sort of I am a disciple of Sidney Lumet and Alan Pakula and John Sturgis and John Ford, and I think where my films might rub certain people the wrong way is the word that you hit upon, which is sincerity.
Yeah.
And it's probably corny, and it's probably weird. It's hard for me. I'm consciously and constantly self-conscious about being self-conscious. That's like saying clear your mind. you're trying not to be, and sometimes I get it, and sometimes I don't, and I know I got a lot to learn, but I want to make Clue. I want to make The Verdict.
Yeah, that would be, it's just great that there's guys like you out there who have not capitulated to what, there's that piece that I wrote, that I put up, I reposted something about called Chaos Cinema, and it was very well cut together video piece that explained the last 10, 12, 15 years of action thrillers and how it's all become fairly hard to follow. The whole point is to jumble your head around to the point that you're really not following it, but the idea is to convey sort of a kind of madness and the clarity in your film and films that like Clue, it's really delightful. So anyway.
Oh, well, thank you. That's a lot of what I learned from working with Tom, specifically the time we spent in the cutting room on Valkyrie, and clarity and geography are the big are the big words we use all the time,
right.
And constantly reminding ourselves, you know, what is happening and where am I in the story?
And
yes, I agree with you. I'm very frustrated when I watch action scenes, and I know, as while I am being carried along by the action scene, I know that I'm not seeing anything coherent. I'm actually assimilating the scene in my head,
mm-hmm.
being stimulated to put together an approximation of what's happening,
right.
and not what's happening. And I understand why, because when I look at the action that I shoot, I get very nervous in the cutting room, because when you shoot things literally, they're not. It's hard to make them dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to make them feel interesting. Your eye has developed such an expectation of what the camera and the cutting meant to do for you.
Right.
That when you see something shot literally, it almost feels like you're watching a car wreck on YouTube. It's not. They're not dynamic.
It's funny, you know. Do you remember a film called Under Fire that Roger Spottiswood did in the 80s?
It was Gene Hackman and Nick Nolte, right?
Right.
And Joanna Cassidy.
Yep. There was a sequence.
First time I saw Ed Harris.
Huh. That's right. Yeah. That was, about 3 years after The Right Stuff. There was a moment where poor Gene Hackman's character is told to lie down in the street by Nicaraguan soldiers, and is then shot in the back of the head, or back in his back, and killed. That was taken from an actual piece of video footage in which that really happened. And something about the spasm of the poor real-life guy's body when he was shot, it was horrifying. No elaboration, it was just raw. I think it might even have been black and white video. But it was so disturbing, and I'll never forget the difference between that. And even though Spottiswood did an excellent job of replicating that moment, the raw video is amazing, how disturbing it is. And to me, that's what good action cinema should always go for, because there is something about things that really happen, and real threats, and actual violence, the way that actually looks. It's just, I don't want that to be lost in our conversation with movies, and too many.
I agree. I completely agree. I think that it's there's something to be made of it, and I feel it's, you know, I feel like if you're going to do that, it can be difficult. The fights can be fun, and mm-hmm. you know, there is a certain, I'm not ashamed to admit, there's a certain visceral thrill that I'm going for when he kills Jai Courtney at the end of the movie, and when he brings, you know, brings those guys to bear for what they've done.
Yeah.
It's the same way in Shane when he kills Jack Palance at the end. But at the same time, you know, it's just to not be so indifferent of it, I'm not interested in getting off on it. And right. you know, the scene that where they kill Alexia Fast, there's a strangely beautiful quality to that shot of her lying on the ground, that close up.
Mm-hmm.
They put their hand over, and we spent a long time where to cut into that scene, where to cut out of that scene.
Mm-hmm.
That it, you know, and it was if we felt the scene was just giving the information, it wasn't enough. It had to go far, but again, not true.
Yeah. Your friend and colleague, Mr. Herzog, who I was delighted to see as part of your cast. I think is that the second kind of supporting actor cameo thing that he's done. There was one he did before recently in a kind of a comedy.
He did one in a. God, I wish I could remember the guy that he did the Loch Ness movie with did a feature. He did a small cameo on that, and he was in Julian Donkey Boy.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, playing a very, very sort of disturbed, very passive aggressive father. Yeah. And Mindy Marin, the casting director, was the one who suggested him.
Right.
I had told her what I was looking for.
Right.
You know, I was using A Prophet.
Yeah.
The that film as a sense of, I can't remember the actor's name, but the guy who played the villain in that movie.
Yeah.
Nils.
Yes, that's right. Nils something. Exactly. Right. who was also used by Spielberg in War Horse briefly.
That's right. That's right. And I loved that performance because he was so unfamiliar. He was real.
Right.
And that was the first name Mindy suggested. And of course, I didn't think for a minute that Herzog would do it.
Yeah.
Then when he agreed to do it, I was terrified of the choice because I thought, is he going to feel almost, you know, like he's in a different movie from everybody else? He's going to feel almost like this, you know, something from one of his documentaries in this heightened Tom Cruise movie.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, it really worked out. I was really glad I did it. And he was great to work with. He's just, I don't know if you've met Herzog. He's
a couple times.
He's really fun.
Yeah. And he's. He's one of my heroes. He said, not to rehash this point we've already worked over, but he was the one who said that really good quote. He said that, very few people watching films today trust their eyes because they know that it's, particularly kids, they all assume it's all on a hard drive, and so nobody really trusts what they see. And he, along with yourself and others, you know, he's a believer in instilling that trust or reinstilling that trust. So, yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely. All right. It's very nice talking to you, Chris. Thank you very much for taking the time, and I appreciate you getting back so quickly, and I'll put this up later today.
Great talking to you, Jeff, and I really appreciate it.
All right, man. Take care.
Thanks, you too.
Bye.